Hey, welcome into another episode of the Vigilant Sports Pacers podcast. I'm Scott Agnes. Well, today on the podcast, I'm joined in studio by Michael Hussein, the director of an upcoming ESPN 30 for 30 short entitled Slick Nancy in the Telethon. Pacer fans by now have surely heard about the infamous telethon that was seen on Channel 4 back in 1977 with the franchise's future in question. They were out of money, and this telethon executed by the Leonards was ultimately what kept the Pacers in Indianapolis and was one of the many factors in leading to the city's great sports landscape. Now, the documentary will be shown on the 6 p.m. edition of SportsCenter on Friday, February 19th, and it will also be posted before then for anyone to view around the world next Tuesday, February 16th. It's just 15 minutes long and was really well done. I got to commend Hussein and his team on putting together a terrific documentary that I think fans will really enjoy. The Leonards are obviously a focal point in the whole thing, and it's fun to hear the stories, see all the photographs, and even the raw footage from that telethon, which turned out to be a big success. Subscribe now to the Vigilant Sports Pacers podcast on iTunes and on Stitcher. Comments and questions, those are all welcome at Scott Agnes on Twitter or scott@vigilantsports.com. For all the details on the project, I sat down with Michael Hussein, who pitched the idea to ESPN and then executed it perfectly. This Pacer Telethon is going to be a special thing. I've already previewed it, and it is spectacular. And now I'm pleased to be joined by the guy, Michael Hussein, in studio, the director. And this is one of those things that there's no front-facing person. So that's you, the director in these 30 for 30 shorts. Is you tell me about the kind of pressure that comes along with that for you, Michael?
No pressure. Other than being able to articulate in interviews like this, it is a really neat medium that ESPN Films has set up, where it's very director focused. This was a very different project that way, in that a lot of documentaries that you produce for television, there's sort of a strict series of guidelines that you have to hit. And this was one where you are directing very freely. So it's your vision, and then they sort of celebrate the idea of filmmaking, which is a rare and very cool thing.
I've worked with ESPN some. I know there's a laundry list of paperwork you got to fill out and directions. What's their, like you said, the direction? Was it a couple pages of requirements that you have to hit for it to be considered?
No, it's not like that. Once they like the idea, then you're the filmmaker and you're the guy to go make it. In fact, the first conference call after they greenlit it, I was going through these things. So, are there standards that you want to do here? I've done work with ESPN before, and it's this, this, and this. They're like, no, this is an easy conference call. We're just kind of kicking it off. You go where you want to go. Just let us know. Keep us in touch of sort of how things are progressing.
Oh, and from your standpoint, you're like, oh, good. Hands off. Let's go.
You get to that, but initially it's like, oh, man. You almost feel more pressure. I hope I don't screw this up. But then it is very freeing. But you do have to kind of relax your mind a little bit.
So with this whole story, for those that don't know, it's back in 1977. The Pacers threatened to leave town just because they were in financial ruin. They needed money to survive, as simple as that. So they held a telethon in short notice. We'll get into all of that. For this ESPN 30 for 30 short, why did you present it to ESPN? Why do you think it was a good enough story that more than those outside of Indianapolis, Central Indiana, Pacers fans needed to see this?
Well, because it was a really unique little story that generationally, there's a lot of people here that don't know the story anymore from, something that happened in 1977. But anyone who's maybe 45, 50 or over kind of knows about it who grew up here. But outside of Indianapolis, very few people know about it. And, the way that sports has grown over the 40 years it is since then is so incredible and overwhelming, the money behind sports, that the idea that a team, a professional sports franchise, was on the verge of bankruptcy because of $2 million
And back then, that's way more than it is today.
Well, that's the idea, is that it was an incredible amount of money to the ownership group. It wasn't the Simons that owned them then. It was a group of six or seven small businessmen, basically. Mm-hmm. And they had sort of maxed out their lines of credit. They didn't have any more money to put in. And so, they really were so strapped that if they didn't come up with this money, they had to move the team. But anyway, getting back to your original question, it's almost unfathomable that today, if you had the Pacers or the Lakers or anybody else say, hey, you know, it's rough times.
We got to throw a last-ditch effort together.
How about you guys, you the community who build our stadiums and pay tickets and pay exorbitant amounts for beer, come and save us? Nobody would believe it, but it happened.
Yeah, that's pretty crazy. So then, before you presented it to ESPN, and I'd like to know how that process works, if it's just you had a source there, a contact there that helped you to it, or there's a formal submission form. But is that something first you kind of do your own research with it, see how easily this can be done? And if, I assume you got to have the Leonards on board with this, or it's not a story.
Yes, you definitely do have to have the Leonards. The initial process for me, I've done a lot of work for ESPN over the years, so it was just a matter of sort of being connected to the person who ran 30 for 30. And so the meeting itself was basically a referral. But there is a formal process that anybody has to go through. And so I had to go through that too, but it helps to have somebody that can connect you.
And they're very particular, and every one of theirs is very good.
Yes.
So
you have to be good enough. And that's, I guess it is a nice compliment to get the meeting. Even then beyond that, so if you can get in the door, then, you know, you have to have some good stories. And so going in with the telethon, it was a story that I had thought about, maybe a decade ago, 9-10 years ago, and did a little bit of research into, there really wasn't a lot of footage of the telethon. It was what I quickly came up against. And so, looking at a traditional full-length documentary, a half hour or an hour, pretty tough to fill that. And so I kind of put it aside, and then as the shorts came along, that one sort of came back out to me as like, you know, maybe we could do that.
Then it's really kind of feasible with what you're working with.
This is like maybe just the right medium. So when I pitched it, it was very quick. The response was like, wait, tell me more. And within 10 minutes, we were pretty sure that we were going to go forward.
Wow. Greenlit kind of. I mean, I'm sure there was a formal process, but.
Yes.
But essentially, you got the okay, yep.
You can sort
keep,
of tell
keep going
in,
down
you can
that
tell
road.
In the room.
Yeah.
And then it maybe took another 2 weeks of some back and forth on paperwork before it was formally greenlit. But I left the room feeling very, very good.
Tell us a little bit about your background, and is this your first directing project? Whatever things have you done for ESPN, Michael?
I have been doing this for a while now, so I've done probably close to a couple hundred hours worth of television programming, most of that nonfiction documentary programming. So for ESPN, I've done, they had a, this is their sort of flagship documentary series now. 8 years ago, it was a series called Sports Century, which was basically their version of A&E's biography, biographical programming about great athletes, coaches. And I did 20, 25 of those episodes for them. We were fortunate enough to win three national Emmys for that work. And did other work for them, have done specials when they did their 25th anniversary special. We did a reenactment of the catch with Joe Montana and Dwight Clark, and were able to be a part of that production. Have done a number of things for ESPN Outdoors. There was a series called The New American Sportsman, which we produced. A hidden camera thing for Outdoors. So yeah, and then a lot of work with Discovery and A&E. I helped launch the series American Justice on A&E, And so that was a very long-running documentary series, criminal justice-driven, A&E biographies, lots of different things.
Take us through the project of putting one of these together. And by this, I mean, how much are you scripting out even before the interviews, how you want to go with this, the research that goes into the interviews, and then the post-production side of things when you're create the still image with a moving effect and having graphics, that whole thing. Share all about that, because I think people would be interested in that.
It's very the first step is always research. So you've got to understand as much as you can about what happened. Since it was a real event, you're not making something up. So you don't really create a script so much as a very detailed outline, and that outline is driven by your research. So you have to understand for instance this who were the owners. For something in 1977, who's still alive? That's a shorter list than you might think.
Unfortunately,
And then reading as much of the background newspapers, that kind of historical research, that you can't shortcut it. You have to just go, just dive in. There haven't been any books written about the telethon, but if it were a different subject, you might read books about things. Once you've got that, then it's, you could take any story and think about what's the newspaper coverage and that sort of thing, and you'd really only be getting the top layer. What you really have to do is talk to the people who were there. And so you start calling people. I called Bill York, who's been at the Pacers forever.
He was on our last podcast,
okay,
actually,
well, there
so
you
there
go.
You go.
I mean, that guy knows where all the skeletons are.
Oh, my goodness,
buried,
yeah. And, stories for days.
Mm-hmm. We called Chet Kopic, who wound up being in the doc because he hosted the telethon. Slick and Nancy, that's a no-brainer. Sandy Knapp, who was with the Pacers during this time, she knows everything, and she was sort of Nancy's right-hand person. And just an incredible resource. Mark Monteith, Bill Benner. There's tons and tons of people that we wound up talking to. For the telethon, one of the things about it is it's quirky. It's a quirky, odd little story. So not only did they put this thing together in a week or so, but, they had to fill 16, 17 hours worth of time. And if you've never done television or radio or anything, that's a tremendous amount of time. You can only talk for so long. So you can only ask for, come on, send us your dollars.
And, how many times can you just try to energize the crowd? Because that's more than anything what you're trying to do. And how many times they brought in special guests to keep the attention of those watching.
Yeah, so they brought in lots of local acts, magicians and jugglers and whoever could fill the time. So we're trying to find who performed because the Leonards or Sandy Knapp remembered these people coming on.
And you want to remember all those, not just for on-camera interviews, but to gather info and little tidbits that maybe we don't know or wasn't in the newspaper article.
Exactly. And so, what was it like backstage? That sort of thing.
Sure, yeah.
We were, you'll get some gems there. Those are the things that you wind up remembering. I saw this documentary about a telethon, and they had this guy that performed, and he was talking about whatever, the licorice was.
Can you believe that we had to do this in order to do that? Yeah.
Yes, exactly.
Those little tidbits.
So, try digging to find those sorts of things. So all of that is research driven. And once you've got, not that the research stops, but you then start to craft your outline to think, okay, who can best articulate this? If I want to go in this direction, who can best articulate? But still not locking yourself into the story, because this one changed. My background is more journalistic, and so I went down sort of a journalistic path with it initially. And then we did the Leonards interview. And now I've met Slick and Nancy, several times. But when you sit down with them and talk through these things, the way and fortunately I had thought far enough in advance that I wanted them to be shot in a two shot, meaning they're both on camera at the same time. We had cameras that got individual shots of them as well, but we did have that two shot because their interactions are so fun. I mean, the way that they roll their eyes at each other, you know, laugh at each other, you know, basically the way old married couples do, saying, you know, he's an idiot, she's an idiot, I can't believe she did this, you know, that sort of thing.
Oh, slick.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, you just picture.
Like, yeah, she
don't
told
bring
him,
that up again.
Yeah, and he said this, and he's like, yeah, I did, you know, that sort of thing was priceless. And so when we got back and started watching that that particular interview, it became sort of more and more clear that the heart and soul of the story was not the physical process of the telethon and the raising money to save a professional sports team. That's a layer of it, and a very important layer of it. But the thing that really gets you, the thing that you remember, is Slick and Nancy. And so they became more a part of the story than originally planned, just because they're so charming like that. And because of what they mean to Indiana basketball, because another key thread here is that Indiana's love affair with basketball is so well documented and so deep that to give it a face was an important consideration and one that I hadn't thought of initially. So when we got into production, we got, you know, it's a short film, so we couldn't do every interview. We couldn't interview 15 people and make it resonate with an audience. You need to kind of buy into a couple of personalities. Slick and Nancy wound up being the key ones. Bill Denner and Chet Kopic were really, that's all we talked with in terms of on camera. And just let the story unfold through their eyes. Bill was a little more objective because he was a reporter at that time. He works for the Pacers now, but and Kopic is a big personality who, and that's, you know, that's one of the reasons he was the host, because he could carry off something like that. So then it was a matter of, you know, you've got, that's sort of the interviews are the spine of the story, so to speak. How it's fleshed out around those bones is the visual material or the audio material. And there really just isn't a lot of visual material left from the telethon. Again, 16 or 17 hours worth of television. But at some point in history, it aired on Channel 4. They tossed out virtually all those elements.
Oh, I was going to say maybe even recorded over them, at some point.
Maybe recorded over and then tossed out.
But I know in some of my previous internships at local TV stations, one of our jobs was to empty out old footage rooms.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's unfortunate for a guy like you, especially, and those historians that really want to go back and find it. And because someone like me, I wasn't alive with the telethon. I have no idea what was happening. This is the first time I had seen true footage from it. It was spectacular.
There are incredible stories in those news vaults, you know. But they do a little bit better job now of donating to the Historical Society or something like that a lot of times when they got a clear space. But there's still a lot of recording over. And, you know, now that things are digital, too, it's just really just adding server space. But in the days of tape, and this was also in that transition between when they used film and then went to the oldest forms of videotape. So the records aren't as good. But anyway, you know, we dug and dug and dug.
How ultimately did you go about finding the footage? I think it was at Channel 13 that had the broadcast, correct?
No, it was a simulcast. 13 and 6 copied what Channel 4 was doing. So Channel 4 was the lead on it. And so Channel 4, fortunately, there was a retrospective that was done, their birthday, and there was some footage in there. And so that's sort of the key area where we were able to find some footage. And then, you know, it's not the first time that I've run up against things where there's no real footage, but there are ways around it. You know, you try and think of, what about audio? Okay, WIBC and some other radio stations were very involved in promoting it and were there for part of the the broadcast. And so we, tried to contact the radio stations. Again, nobody's got real deep archives, at least that included the telethon. What about photographs? Just still photos. The Star certainly covered it, but they only had, and I talked to, because when you watch the little bit of footage that we have, you can see at least two photographers, still photographers running around. Okay.
So now you go try to find those guys or their outlet.
Yeah. So you send footage to a couple of people and say, do you know who that guy is? And so I found at least one of the photos, or photographers, and, he remembered shooting it. But the archives would have been with the Star. The Star at this point only has three photos.
Wow.
Three photos.
Oh, that's troubling for a guy like you. Yeah, you're hoping they have a database of 7,500. Today it's probably 800.
Yeah,
but.
The negatives. All I got to do is find a contact sheet that showed what all the negatives were.
Oh, man.
And then I can dig in and find what I need. I can tell the story that way. And I got three photos. So, you're basically kind of stuck with, okay, I've got three photos. We actually only wound up using two, as it turned out.
And then you build creative ways to display those on the screen. So it's not just, here's a picture.
Here's a picture. Well, so what we did was put those photos in an environment. So put one, and we found a 70s era studio television camera, and shot a photo of everybody, the stage, the set for the telethon, and shot it from like five different angles. So we used it, four or five times. We took the telethon footage that we had, which is only a couple of minutes worth of footage, and dropped it into an old television of the 70s era, and then shot that. So not only do you see the telethon footage full screen, but then you cut out and you see a TV and a and maybe a Pacers banner, and you come around the old black and white, or colored, slightly colored television, those that kind of really muted from the 70s, that feel that's a little grainy. So because part of what we wanted to do in the original outline, the kind of creative brief, was to capture the 70s. One of the first things you see when you watch this footage is Slick's suits. I mean, they're shocking. They're brightly colored, massive collars. It's the disco era. It's like it's just amazing. So the 70s hair is there. He's got massive sideburns. So we wanted to get the feel of the 70s. The kind of at this point it's sort of fun and funny to look at.
Absolutely.
And so. So getting the old television was part of that. It was part of like just saying, remember the 70s were, while they're not that far ago, it's a long time ago. That's one of the reasons that this telethon could happen where it happened, Indiana, and when it happened in the 70s.
And I assume digitally you put a picture in there, if I recall right.
No,
there was a picture in there on the TV.
We fed the telethon footage.
Oh, okay.
So we took I can't remember if it was a DVD. Yeah, we made a DVD of the footage.
See, it's these little things, like for what could be a 5-second moving frame,
yes.
You might invest 30 minutes to a couple hours,
easily hours
into an environment.
Yeah, because first of all, we weren't sure the TV was going to work. And then we got it so that it's turning on. We didn't need sound. We just needed the picture tube to work.
Mm-hmm.
And so then, it had the old kind of rabbit ears reception thing, and this engineer guy was able to figure out a way basically to feed the footage into the TV.
I figured you had a digital post-production trick on that one.
No, it's actually fed and it's playing. And then we were in a studio, and then we just did camera moves around the footage as it played. So we ran that 2 minutes worth of footage on that old TV probably 10 different times and created different camera moves. We just looped it, and then when we want to cut in during the documentary, we might just take a 10-second clip here, 10-second clip there. It's footage you've probably already seen in the doc, but we're repeating it in this environment, and it's fresh to your eyes. So it helps, for me, milk time so I can tell the story.
Mm-hmm. And I thought, going back to how you utilize those pictures and stuff, I thought it was a cool shot. So simple, but I believe, if I recall right, you had a still picture on top of a camera with the on-air or something light on, the red light.
Exactly.
Just kind of indicating, hey, it's a telethon, it's live, here's the image from it, and here's the camera just to add a nice little feel to it. And just small environment, but I like it.
Yeah, I mean, you do... You do what you can, and
how many of those do you record and never use?
In this one, we had 3 photos. We wound up using 2, so we also did record some photos of Slick coaching and things like that. Just weren't exactly telethon related.
But as far as the environments that you create, or every environment you make and spend hours on, you're going to use.
No. Sometimes you just don't use them. Yeah. And sometimes you're not sure. Like, okay. Do we shoot that photo you're talking about on top of the camera? We might have also shot it next to, like, because this was 16 and a half hours, and they were Slick was a chain smoker back then. So, we also shot that, I think, in front of an ashtray with, like, cigarettes burning and just kind of that smoke rising, and wound up not using it in that environment. You do shoot things that you don't use. There's lots and lots of footage. The interviews alone, I think we talked to Slick and Nancy for probably well over an hour.
It's like a 14-15 minute short. Yes. So even though they're maybe on camera or their audio is used for a couple minutes, mm-hmm. you're probably still using all kinds of their facts and info that they showed throughout the documentary.
Definitely. They're giving you, while you do a pre-interview with them on the phone and things like that, what people tell you on camera is just, it's gold. For you, these are the people who lived it. These are the people who really drove the bus. So there's lots of stuff that they gave us, not only that inform facts and stories that go into the thing, but they inform maybe how you might ask, like, there might have been something they said that drove a question that I asked to Bill Benner later.
Yeah, they tipped you off to something.
Yeah, that I
you
didn't
just
know.
Weren't aware of.
Right, and you can really only get that through conversation, and that's. Again, another one of those things that it's not purely journalistic. It's a film, and so a lot of it is getting a feel for things. And memories are fuzzy after 40 years. So, Slick and Nancy might remember the prep time of this as a week. We came up with the idea. We had a week to pull it off. Somebody else might remember it as 10 days or 14 days, but. Whatever it is, it's an incredibly tight window of time.
To put on something so long, going live, and the number of acts they had to sign up and take in to fill time.
Well, one of the
it's amazing they got it on.
One of the great little stories that's not in the film ultimately, but there was a guy here in town, a Dr. Rushmore. I actually think he's still alive. He had done a lot of work prepping out Jerry Lewis telethons for muscular dystrophy, which he had worked on those things. Somebody knew about him, so when they came up with the idea for the telethon, like, one of the first calls they made was to this guy, and he heard what they were trying to do, and in the time frame they were trying to do it, and he laughed at him. He said, "It takes a minimum of 6 months to pull this off. How would you even get time on television?" You're asking a week from now for a television station to completely bump their schedule and allow you to sit on there for 16 or 17 hours?
Did they donate that time, or how did that work?
Channel 4 was their broadcast partner, and it was an independent station. So CBS or ABC or NBC couldn't have done it. It just would have been impossible contractually. But an independent station could. The station manager was a guy named Don Tillman, who now is a professor out at in USC. He wiped the schedule clean, said, whatever you need, we'll do it. I mean, it was in their interest, too. That's their team. If that team leaves town, they got nothing.
It's less of an intrigue and excitement to the city. Yeah.
But anyway, this Dr. Rushmore said, how are you going to fill the time? How are you going to do that? All these things that have to be done over the course of 6 months, they pulled together, at lightning speed. That's a little story that, we didn't have time for. It took us a little bit out of, our story. But is a good little nugget.
Yeah. With this ESPN 30 for 30 short, it's a little less than 15 minutes. If you had it your way, is that about right? Would you like to go 20? Would you have gone an hour?
For this one, it's right.
Okay.
It's There just isn't enough footage that would hold a viewer's eyes and interest in a longer piece. If you were doing a feature film on it and you had actors and you could make the sets and do everything you wanted to do, mm-hmm. it's a great story. There's all these, you could then, you know, mimic the acts. You could mimic the meeting with, you know, Dr. Rushmore and those sorts of things. And you could easily do a 2-hour feature just on this little story if you wanted to. So yeah, whoever wants to make the feature film, let me know. But,
and you'll take care of it.
Yes.
Yeah, right.
But for a documentary short film like this, this is just about the perfect length.
Let's hit some of the nuts and bolts of this whole thing. Do you know approximately how many hours of footage that you maybe filmed throughout this whole thing?
I've never totaled it up, but in general, I would say that's a 40 to 50 to 60 to 1 ratio, something like that.
Okay.
So, you know, like if you do an hour long piece, you could easily do 50, 60 hours of shooting to get down to that that 1 hour. So this is a 15-minute piece, you know, whatever the math is on that.
Yeah. Then from concept to the research, from that point till today, how long have you been working on this?
I don't know. I would guess that it's probably one that would it would drive me crazy if I really went back and looked at it, because you know you're making below minimum wage if you figure out how many hours you put in. But it's a joy. So it's really not, you're not looking at it from that perspective. It's you want to do the best job possible on this story that you're kind of really into.
If you don't mind sharing, as far as payment goes for you, is it based at all by views or anything, or is it just let's knock it out?
No, we knock it out. And we're going to, this is what we do. So, you know, make it work within this. I'm like, okay.
They technically own it.
Yeah. So you complete it and deliver it to them and, you know, they run it and do whatever they want with it.
How big of crew did you have, or is it just you and you hire them for the work that you need done?
Yep, that's there are a couple of guys that are really fine camera operators, directors of photography that I wanted to use on this. You know, Andy Young and Vinny Manganiello, and so they came and helped, you know, with all the shoots. And kind of created the look, you know, getting that nice fluid motion on the old photos or the old television, the shots at the arena, you know, looking through the net and seeing Slick's you know, Hall of Fame banner, that sort of thing. You know, they really provide some beautiful visual elements for that. The editor, a guy named Mark Costello, is, you know, just a talented guy. And so, but it's a pretty small group, and, it's very collaborative. While the, you know, director gets to do these fun interviews and, you know, be the guy, as you said, it really is a team. There's no way this stuff ever gets done without a team.
So take us on set, for instance, when you're talking with Slick and Nancy Leonard. Mm-hmm. You sitting in a chair beside, asking questions off camera with the two guys you just mentioned shooting. Mm-hmm. Is that what the setup is like?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So there, for that particular piece, we had two cameras. I'm there essentially between the two cameras, and just having what you try and do is to get the interviewees, in this case, Slick and Nancy, to relax. Everybody is always freaked out when there's a camera around. Now Slick is on TV and radio all the time, sure. So he's completely comfortable with it. And Nancy's been around long enough that she is too. But what you want to get to is a conversation. You want to have people let their guards down. And you know, and some of the questions, for instance, Slick certainly has answered 1,000 times. And you kind of get into you know, a routine of what you answer at a certain question. What were the ABA days like? Well, they were great. It was crazy. You know, our guys competed, and you know,
we go a million different ways with that.
We went after them all the time, and it was so much fun. You know, and so, but you have to follow that up. You have to get deeper than that for a documentary, and so that's a conversation. That's a lot of listening, a lot of follow up questions, and making people forget the surroundings, the camera, the lights, the microphone they're wearing, the microphone above their head. You know, that stuff is all kind of gets in the way of the first 5 or 10 minutes of an interview. And then as you're talking, hopefully they forget it. and just start talking to you. So you maintain eye contact and you listen really well. And you're constantly thinking about how does what they say play into the story I think I'm going to tell, and yet also not be so rigid that you don't hear what they say. And if it's different than what you thought it was going to be, go with that. And allow them to elaborate, and maybe you got something better than what you thought you had.
Yeah, I'm sure you come in, I don't know, a page of questions of what you think you want to cover, but you can't just, all right, number one, number two, or otherwise, one, it doesn't sound great, and they're just, it's very back and forth.
Yep.
And then also, they may take you, as you said, they may take you in a totally different direction or bring up something you had no clue about.
Yep, it happens all the time. And, you know, what I try and do myself is really go over those questions that I have written down a number of times before they ever sit down. So what I like to do is I have it there, but I then very visibly let them see me put it aside. So I'll take those questions and put them aside so that they don't think that I'm just running down a list of questions for them.
Okay.
And that we can start a conversation. Now, at a break, you know, so we might talk for 40 minutes and we got to change a battery or something like that. I'll pull that sheet back out, look, check off what I've done, see, okay, there's five things I still got to get to, put it aside again.
Is that a lesson you learned from anyone in particular? I'm curious.
Just over time. I think I did it once. I happened to be better prepared for some interview than I thought I was, and so I didn't need it. And I, you know, I actually, now that you mentioned it, I hadn't thought back. This was 15, 20 years ago. I saw the interviewee looking at my question list just sitting on my lap. I saw their eye line would kind of go down to that every
now and
then.
So they're probably already
thinking
ahead.
What's the next thing?
What am I going to say?
I'm like, you know, that's the unnatural that I don't want in this process. So I took it and I put it under my chair. And it worked like that. That interview went better. So it was something I tried to repeat. And it's generally worked pretty well.
As we talked about beforehand, without Nancy, I mean, you can't tell the full story. And I think there should be a statue in front of Bankers Life Fieldhouse of Slick, but you got to have Nancy right there with him.
No question.
What'd you learn about just Nancy and the role she played in everything and still plays today? Because she drives that ship.
That's what I learned. I learned that she drives that ship. You know, you don't get Slick on camera for something like this unless Nancy signs off first. And you have to... Nancy has to believe in what you're doing. She's very protective of Bob, as she calls him. She doesn't call him Slick.
Yeah, that's interesting. Because everyone nowadays,
sure,
even at Banker's Life, calls him Slick.
Yeah, and he doesn't mind it. I don't think they mind it. It's just, he wasn't Slick when she met him.
It's just what you know.
She was Bob, or he was Bob. She's super, super smart. She does not forget anything. So you can say something and a month later, bring it back up. She's, oh yeah, I remember, she's, I don't know, they're in their 80s. You would think she's in her 50s. She's just sharp and she goes to every game. She's like the biggest fan, there is.
On that note, there's a couple shots at the very beginning, I think the end, still holding hands, they're walking in.
Yeah. Well, they're in love.
Walking into Banker's Life, and you wouldn't know that they've been married 50 years if you just heard them or saw what the actions they showed towards each other.
Again, once we realized that was going to be a significant part of the film, it became not so much a telethon story. In fact, the initial title of it was The Telethon. It became Slick, Nancy, and The Telethon. Because it's a love story. It's they met at IU. Bob was a star basketball player there and won the national championship for IU in 53 with a late free throw. And, she was, his fiance. He went off to war, went off to the military and came back. And then had a great pro career but she became so knowledgeable about basketball through their relationship, and she's such a fan. So their basketball you just can't unravel it from their life and their relationship. It's just a part of them. And so that was a really nice metaphor, I thought, for the entire state of Indiana. where basketball is such a critical part of growing up here. There just isn't a kid who doesn't shoot around in their driveway. And it's been that way forever, class basketball or not. You know, it's just people here love this sport and will do almost anything for it. And so that feeds ultimately into the telethon, not only Slick and Nancy's participation because they were employed by the Pacers, but also what the city and the community was asked to do, come and save professional basketball here. So those themes, and their love, you know, they
it's pretty cool.
It is, they're the grandparents that everybody wishes they had, you know. Yeah. You see them, as you say, holding hands or just chuckling with one another, you know. Sometimes when you watch people laugh with one another, you kind of see it in their eyes. And
yeah, they're just giggling like they're 18. Yes, and exactly. In love for the first time.
Yes.
It's still going.
Yep.
So this thing's called Slick Nancy in the Telethons. Right there says directed by you, Michael Hussein. In a short, director, how do you define what that role is for something like this?
The biggest part of it is the crafting and that outline and creative brief and taking that through to the finish. So it's like a funnel. You know, the wide part is when you're just in the outline stage, and you narrow and narrow down to the, so you choose who we're going to interview to tell the story. What's it going to look and feel like? Directing those cameras in the field. You know, I want to make sure that we have a shot that goes, left to right, because I know we're going to come out of something else that goes right to left, and I want a contrast. So all sorts of little things like that. Color schemes. Do we infuse a little blue or a little gold into things just because those are Pacer colors, whatever it might be. And then because the interviews are the bones of the piece, driving and conducting those interviews. So, again, you can be a good listener or not a good listener and ask questions based upon that. So the director really, really drives or directs that.
Sure. How many versions of this did you have? Was it one of those where you made several edits along the way, and this was that fourth and final piece? And were any of those coming from ESPN and said, hey, let's change this? Or do you have complete control over the finished product?
You have complete control, but they certainly suggest, and they're smart suggestions. I've certainly worked with executive producers at networks where you get a suggestion and you think it's, you know, that is not for the betterment of the
story. Where's this coming
from?
He just doesn't understand.
Driven, or yeah. It's just ego-driven. It's like, I can make a suggestion, so I will. None of this was like that. These were all great suggestions, and they were outsiders to the story, more or less. So, hearing, boy, when this chuckle happens, make sure you don't cut that off, because it was great. You know, that moment was really stuck with me.
And being an outsider provides a unique perspective, because even I know this, right? In your storage, you know how you want it. So sometimes you'll mistakenly do something, or in writing, you know, have words that shouldn't be there, or you misspell. You just need an outside perspective to look it over several times.
Everyone needs an editor. You look at the great authors of, modern day, Stephen King or whatever. And I promise you, his editor does tremendous work for him and never gets credit for that. So there are always, good, trusted eyes looking at things and giving you feedback and suggestions. You don't have to take it, but a lot of times it's better than what you would have done anyway, or complimenting what you've done, so you want to make sure you don't lose it. To answer your question, there were probably five or six different versions before we got to the final.
Couple last hits I want to hit on. Most memorable thing for you about this entire project?
I'm a relationship guy, so really getting to know Nancy a little bit was a lot of fun. I just think she's great. I think it's her story more than anything. The credit, for instance, that Bob gives her for, she was technically the assistant general manager during those ABA Pacer days. But he says it on camera. He says, like, there wasn't no assistant about it. It was, she was the general manager. I was the coach. They had that title because I was a man essentially, but she did all the work, and she really, she motivated people. She and Sandy Knapp sat in the conference table looking. They'd been, management had told them, look, we don't have any money, and they're like, oh, what are we gonna do? How do we fix this? So they didn't just sit on their hands and say, well, we can't do anything. They said, we got to find something. We got to do something. And so, the Pacers, as we know them, the field house, all that doesn't exist.
Yes.
If Nancy sits on her hands that day in 1977 and says, I can't do anything. Sorry.
And there was a great shot. Folks will see at the very end where she gets emotional. Hey, we did this.
Mm-hmm.
That was a nice ending to the whole story.
Yeah. Yeah. And there are plenty of people who will tell you that not only did they save the Pacers and what the Pacers have become, but there's no way the Colts, a professional football franchise, would have come here in the early 80s without the knowledge that the fan base would support them.
It's amazing how drastic difference the city would be if there's no Pacers, because then there's no RCA Dome, then there's no Colts.
There's no Super Bowl.
Then there's no Super Bowl. There's no Final Fours. There's no Big Ten tournaments, those types of things.
The NCAA never moves here
without
that sort of thing. It's like anything, you pull at a thread and you could unravel an entire sweater. That was a really critical moment, that telethon, as quirky and odd and homespun as it was. I mean, you see the photos and the pictures, and it's like the set is like made of cardboard. There's like, they got some tables that they've put like a blue banner around, and then it's like written in hand, save the Pacers. It's like the Chick-fil-A cows have created a set.
One thing you wish you could have done, one person maybe you wish you could have talked to that you could not.
I think more than anything, I wish that we could have gotten. I wish the footage existed of the odd performers and that sort of, just kind of weird mood around this 16 and a half hour thing. And so some of the oddity of it would have been fun to have. I do think, though, the result of that not being around is that the story has never been done before. And so. Because it didn't exist and was sort of, easier fruit to pick for somebody else, I think I was able to do the piece because that footage didn't exist.
Last thing, as a director, when it comes out, when it's airing on TV, what are you doing? You holding a viewing party? What do you do? You got to celebrate, right?
Yeah, you do.
At least with close friends and family.
Friends and family, yeah.
Pop a bottle of champagne or something.
Or a beer, anyway. But, I'm not going to do the Peyton Manning, but... it's going to run on SportsCenter on the 19th in the 6 to 7 p.m. window. So, I'll have, first of all, I'll be recording that, and second of all, watch it. And it's fun. It's funny when you watch the stuff come across, you're still sitting in the living room.
With your director's hat on?
No beret, sorry. And it just feels like a TV show. I mean, I know I created it, but you're not seeing, if there's 500,000 people that watch SportsCenter from 6 to 7, mm-hmm. I don't see 500,000 people. You don't get that response.
Yeah.
So it's like kind of cool to back your head to know that, there's more people, and your phone will blow up. But in general, it's just, it's a cool moment. It is. But it's not like... I've had films shown in theaters, and then you can see the audience reacting over the course of the film. That's a very different thing. So it's not like that, but it's pretty awesome nonetheless.
This is spectacular. I'm glad you did it, and I look forward to seeing it again and for everyone to check it out. Slick Nancy in the Telethon. Michael Hussain joining me here today, the director, the guy that had it from concept to ESPN. I appreciate it, Michael. Thanks so much. And congratulations. It was really good.
Yeah, thank you. I'm glad you liked it.
Thanks again to Michael Hussain for joining me in studio. I enjoyed our conversation there. Again, this 30 for 30 short on Slick, Nancy, and the Telethon will air on the 6 o'clock edition of SportsCenter on Friday, February 19th, and can be seen online as soon as Tuesday, the 16th. Shoutouts for this week Number one, Paul George, who heads to his third All-Star weekend to the Pacers for beginning construction on the brand-new St. Vincent Center, which should be completed in just about a year, and to Miles Turner for letting the former Pacer Roy Hibbert use his blazer when the Lakers were in town. Be sure to follow the Vigilant Sports Pacers podcast on iTunes and on Stitcher. If you like the podcast, please tell a friend. Thanks for listening, everyone.